it's coming to a crunch time here.
Yeah, I think everybody looked at it that way and wanted to, and were asking themselves, you know, who's right and who's wrong? Or is there an area of compromise here that we can both live with? Sure, I think that it was going through all the players' minds.
Suppose Kuhn hadn't come along and prevailed on the owners to give in a bit. Suppose Chubb Feeney or somebody, one of the real power brokers for the owners, had been named commissioner. I realize it's hypothetical, but do you think the players would have held together? There were some signs that
There might have been some cracks. Then I think, you know, when you really look back, hindsight, it doesn't help ownership to have a divided players' association. I tell you why. Because they're playing together and they're playing against each other. But those who are divided and playing on the same team, you're going to have a divided team. You don't want a divided team. Mm-hmm. It's only going to hurt you. You want guys that are going to pull for each other, back each other, battle for each other, all the way down the line. And if the ownership breaks up or divides and you have, like the NFL,
yeah.
They, you know, their problems they went through because of divisions, and you'd have the same situation, I don't know if the owners would have liked that, to tell you the truth. I think they let it get too far out of hand the other end, but because that's the short-sighted sidedness. But I think, as it turned out, it was better that the players were together in the situation than divided.
Interestingly, a couple of the teams that showed some erosion during February were the Mets and the Cubs. Both came out and had the strong seasons. Sure, I'll just... Were there signs on the Giants that winter that players...
68?
Yeah, 68,
69. Oh, I imagine there were some Giants that...
I mean Dodgers, you were... Excuse me, Dodgers.
The winter of 68, he was traded that winter.
No, I mean the winter of 68, 69.
Oh, you were already with the Dodgers. Yeah, see, now, I wasn't the player rep at that time. I was just a national
Just the league rep.
Yeah, and I don't recall, not living in the area, I don't recall a whole lot that was said about it. I lived up in Northern California. I wasn't in that close contact with the players in the wintertime, other than the meetings we may have had, you know, back in New York or something, and then all the players weren't involved. But I think that there were some indications that with the Dodgers, I realized that O'Malley's were very influential in baseball, and I think there were several players that were a little reluctant about going along with the whole idea. But as it turned out, it turned out on a positive note.
Yeah, it did. Miller says it's the only time that Kuhn actually acted in the best interest of baseball.
Yeah, yeah.
It fascinates me, the timing of that whole dispute going on all winter, and really, you know, lingering from 2 years before, from the first negotiations.
Yeah.
Right. And the owners kind of stonewalling, and Miller trying to get one wedge at a time in there. And it looks like it's really coming to a crisis head there in February, and Kuhn comes along, the owner's man, and gets the owners to.
Yeah, you got to remember one thing. Kuhn, I think, it was in either 65 or 66 in the first negotiations with Martin. Realize how good this guy was at that. He was the guy that caved in initially. And he knew, I'm positive in his own mind, he knew that Marvin was not going to be just brushed aside. They were going to have a battle on their hands. And I think the fact that they did make him commissioner was helpful to the players, because he had the insight of having to deal with them before he became the commissioner, and knew that he had a bulldog in Marvin Miller. And you better sit down and try to reason with this guy instead of trying to be the bully on the beach, because you're going to get sand kicked in your face if you didn't sit down and reason with this guy. So I think, you know, that because he was named commissioner, he had that insight of what had gone on previous to that point.
Do you think that the sense of unity that came out of that that winter and spring was a foundation?
Yeah, definitely, because then the leap ahead a little bit, in the winter of 1970, up until 1970, player representatives and everybody in ownership had always met in the same town for the winter meetings, right? The same time.
Even if you got brushed off, they were in the same town.
Right. 1970, said, hell with it. Why are we going there? We're not getting anything accomplished. Let's go to where we want to go, you know, maybe enjoy it and have our own meetings, because and then we'll get back. Now, this was, of course, now with the director, you could do that, because you got a mouthpiece, you got someone dealing for you. So we ended up going to Puerto Rico, and we had our player rep meetings, and that was on the heels of Kirk Flood.
Kirk Flood, right. My next
project. Right. And so in our meeting down in Puerto Rico, the Kirk Flood thing was thoroughly discussed. And the other thing about the 1970 meeting that we discussed at some length was free agency. The players at that time wanted to try to instill a free agency package or get something going in that direction. And of course, ownership was dead against it, because all they could see was turmoil under those circumstances. The players at that time thinking was, hey, 10 years, and then let the owners then become a free agent. Let the owners have a chance to develop their product, get some good out of it. After 10 years, the team is going to know whether or not they want to keep that guy anyway, right?
Right.
And after 10 years, you're going to get the best, in most instances, out of that player, because after that, he's going to be more in the downhill than he is in this direction. And we, as players, we thought that would be a heck of a workable deal. Well, you know, there were things sent to ownership to give them those ideas, and of course we got a stonewall. No, no way. Kirk Flood deals goes to the Supreme Court. They kick it out back to the legislature. You know, our great Congress. Congress says no, doesn't do anything with it. And then of course the guy in Kansas City, the judge in Kansas City, opens the Pandora's box.
Oliver,
Andy Messerschmidt. Right? Open Pandora's box. And then Messerschmidt. Sure, you can become a free agent. I think that was it. And then you had the left-handed pitcher.
McNally, yeah.
McNally.
Seitz, really, but Oliver upheld Seitz, yeah.
Right. Oh, was that the judge?
Seitz was the arbitrator, but they appealed it to Judge Oliver.
Uh-huh.
And upheld it.
And he upheld it. And boom, all shit hit the fan. Everybody's scrambling now, see. 76, they sat down. And not in the best interest of baseball, Kuhn negotiated that free agency deal and arbitration deal that has now got baseball in a vice. That's what happens.
Yeah. In 68, you didn't really, nobody really dreamed about.
No, but in 68...
Free agency.
No, we were looking more at I guess you would say, the nuts and bolts. Basic agreement.
Pension and working conditions. Working
right.
Conditions.
And increased minimum salaries. That type of thing. But as, and boy, from 68 up through, you know, 70, 71, to, oh man, you know, it was just going so fast now. And now the ownership in 76, they have the problem and they get the free agency and all that stuff. So, you know, it's from 68 to 76, eight short years, look how far it traveled. Whereas before it took forever to get to there.
Miller has an interesting theory about during the Flood lawsuit, the baseball people were forced to abandon the premise that the commissioner could be an impartial
arbitrator.
And in making the claim that the reserve clause was a matter for bargaining, they let that door open. And even though Flood lost the case, it was really it was disastrous for Flood, obviously, but it was a Pyrrhic victory for the owners.
Right.
They won the case, but they lost the premise.
Exactly.
They lost their foothold.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, ever since Marvin came on board, you know, he tried to convince the players that, hey, wait a minute, you know, the commissioner of baseball is the owner's commissioner. He's not, a true commissioner of baseball would come down on both sides. But he's an employee of ownership. Players didn't have anything to do to elect the commissioner. You know that? But up until that point, players just thought, hey, man, this commissioner is for baseball. Well, you had a couple of great commissioners. You had Judge Landis. Mm-hmm. You know, you had Happy Chandler. Then you had some real duds in between, you know, from there. And, you know, it's I think this guy today is a good commissioner. I'm sure he takes some heat, but he's not making some popular moves. But I think the move he made...
with the Cubs.
And they did a study. I think the Cubs, the one I saw last night on television, two games is what they lose out of the time zones that they were complaining about. They're going to be too many night games because of from the West Coast. Two games. Now, I don't know how accurate this reporter was, but that's what he came up with.
I just can't see how the Cubs would be hurt very much. They've got such a strong fan base.
Yeah,
those people are going to watch the games. They're going to watch the games. Yeah. Fascinating to go back to '68 and realize how much confusion and dissension there was with expansion the first time. The National League wanted to go to strict 12 team, one division, and then two sixes, and the American League, and they were going to have different number of games in the schedules, and it was really pretty chaotic.
A year ahead of time.
Yeah.
They jumped the gun. So there was a little, feud going on between...
Did you have to sweat the expansion possibility?
I didn't even know. I didn't really care. I didn't care. No, you mean in
68.
The first one.
The first one. You were still in the minors then, right?
First one, I was on the big league club in 61, and that's when the American League went to it. The National League didn't have to provide players. And then in 62, when the Astros came in. And who else?
The Mets.
Mets, that's right. Yeah. No, I don't think I was... I think I was protected.
What did it feel like being traded for the first time?
Well, it was... it's always kind of an odd feeling, I think, the first time being traded. Especially going from the Giants to the Dodgers, which are arch rivals, right? But a nice thing about it was that I went from Northern California, Southern California. I was on the same coast, and it made it easy, an easy transition. It was done in the winter before spring training. Mm. Made it easy to go into spring training, get to know all the players through that exercise. So I didn't mind that at all. And for me, it gave me another look at a different philosophy of baseball. The Giants were... philosophy on baseball was one of more of a home run type of hitting ball club. We had guys could poke it out at any ballpark any given time. And the Dodgers were one based on speed and defense and strong pitching. Not that every club didn't want to have strong pitching, but they really honed in on those three aspects where the Giants, we looked at that time more for the power. We get a couple guys on, I hope one of the Willies would hit one, Orlando or Jim Mayhart or somebody like that.
And I've read how you adapted your batting style at the Dodger Stadium.
I didn't think I was strong enough to hit. I up in Cal State, the wind blew to right field, and I averaged about...
Until they closed it off,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, of course. Was it?
That was much
in the
later.
70s.
Yeah.
71, I think, where they were working on it. 71, weren't they? Yes, in fact, 71 they were working on it because that's when they won the division, and it wasn't finished.
And they were putting in AstroTurf, too.
Right, they played Pittsburgh, you remember? And so I never really saw it completely finished as a player, enclosed. And so the wind was definitely a left-handed hitter's advantage. And right. Dodger Stadium at that time, go ahead.
Yeah.
In the 60s. Home plate was 10 feet closer to the backstop, and the fence that made the fences that much farther, and they had subsequently moved in the fences too. So it was a bigger ballpark then than it is now. It looked tougher, and I think the ball today, and I'm not trying to be prejudiced in any way, but I think the ball today is juiced up a heck of a lot more than